36. The Material World as the Great Forest of Enjoyment is the full title. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. This verse is also in prose. Kvachit kshina thanaha shayasanashanad yupabhoga vihino yavat apratilabdha manorato pakatatane vasitamatis tatastato vamanadini janat abhilabhate. Word for word, kvachit, sometimes, kshinathanaha, not having sufficient money, shaya asana, ashana adi, accommodations for sleeping, sitting or eating, upabhoga, of material enjoyment, vihinaha, being bereft, yavat, as long as, apratilabdha, not achieved, manoratha, by his desire, upagata, obtained, adane, in seizing by unfair means, avasitamati, whose mind is determined, tataha, because of that, tataha, from that, avamana adini, insults and punishment, janat, from the people in general, abhilabhate, he gets. Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sometimes, having no money, the conditioned soul does not get sufficient accommodations. Sometimes he doesn't even have a place to sit, nor does he have the other necessities. In other words, he falls into scarcity, and at that time, when he is unable to secure the necessities by fair means, he decides to seize the property of others unfairly. When he cannot get the things he wants, he simply receives insults from others, and thus becomes very morose. Purport. It is said that necessity knows no law. When the conditioned soul needs money to acquire life's bare necessities, he adopts any means. He begs, borrows, or steals. Instead of receiving these things, he is insulted and chastised. Unless one is very well organized, one cannot accumulate riches by unfair means. Even if one acquires riches by unfair means, he cannot avoid punishment and insult from the government or the general populace. There are many instances of important people's embezzling money, getting caught and being put in prison. One may be able to avoid the punishment of prison, but one cannot avoid the punishment of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who works through the agency of material nature. This is described in Bhagavad Gita 7:14. Daivihesha gunamai mama maya duratyaya. Nature is very cruel. She does not excuse anyone. When people do not care for nature, they commit all kinds of sinful activities, and consequently they have to suffer. Kvachit kshina dhanaha shayasanashanat yupubhoga vihino yavat apratilabdha manorato pakadatane vasitamatis tatasato vamanadini janat abhilabhate. Sometimes having no money, the conditioned soul does not get sufficient accommodations. Sometimes he doesn't even have a place to sit, nor does he have the other necessities. In other words, he falls into scarcity, and at that time, when he is unable to secure the necessities by fair means, he decides to seize the property of others unfairly. When he cannot get the things he wants, he simply receives insults from others, and thus becomes very morose. We are still working our way through the forest of so-called enjoyment. It seems like it's been months that we're stuck inside the forest where the bushes are scratching us and there's no clear path. We have to hack our way through the jungle to try to get out of it, to try to get to the other side. And there's so many miseries inflicted upon us within this forest. So at least a couple of months, it seems, we've been going through these verses. And the good news is we're almost out. There's two or three more verses, and we'll be done with this great forest of enjoyment. The previous chapter, this chapter is almost a repeat of the previous chapter where Jatabharat was describing the forest to Maharaj Rahugana, but in this chapter, because the king could not understand properly, he's giving more explanation. So we're almost cleared our way out of this forest of enjoyment. In this verse, particularly talking about poverty, the living entity in the poverty-stricken condition of life, where he does not even have the basic necessities, does not have a place to stay, does not have a place to sit, does not have sufficient money or food. In such a situation, we can see in the world that people become very desperate just to, as Prabhupada would say, keep body and soul together. Devotees are supposed to maintain our life in the mood of keeping body and soul together, just the minimum bare necessities. And generally, devotees, we all have those bare necessities taken care of by the mercy of the Lord. But in places or in situations where people don't have these bare necessities, then so many crimes and atrocities are committed. You can see in war zones or in places where there are natural disasters or famines, the people become so uncontrolled, so wild, and without hesitation they'll steal from other unfortunate people, they'll kill to get food. All sorts of atrocities may be committed just out of desperation to stay alive. So it's a very unfortunate, difficult situation for such people, as mentioned in this verse. Of course, Prabhupada also talks about embezzlement, important people's embezzling money, being caught and put in prison. So this is another kind of stealing that goes on. But whereas the people who are struggling just to survive, you know, we can have some compassion or understanding that these people are really desperate. If they don't steal, if they don't loot, they may die of hunger. So there is some little justification. There's some justification in that. But the so-called important people's embezzling money, as Prabhupada mentions here, there's so many instances of this. And Prabhupada is writing this in the 70s. And even nowadays, you know, every so often in the news, there's some minister, some bank, you know, head of banks, some very big people, they're arrested, they're caught and exposed because they're stealing money, they're cheating people, they're taking bribes. These things are going on all over the world. So in such a case, these people don't have any real need, no necessity of doing that. They're already wealthy, already well situated, they have all the necessities of life taken care of. But just out of greed, out of pride, out of envy, they're trying to cheat others, they're trying to increase their artificial necessities, they don't feel they won't be satisfied unless they get more and more and more. Now, for such people, there's very little sympathy for such people. They try to steal and cheat from the poorer people, and when they're caught and imprisoned, people feel very satisfied, you know, that justice has been served. Whereas the really poor people, when they commit some crime just to survive, you know, we can be more sympathetic to them. Of course, Prabhupada says, quotes a Hindi saying, "Hira chor ya hira chor, chor to chor hai." Means if you steal a cucumber or steal a jewel, valuable jewels, you're still a thief. But still, there is some consideration of severity of crime. So today I was planning to discuss a little bit about this principle of poverty and wealth and what that means in Krishna consciousness. Different examples of devotees in our history, Vaishnava history from Shastra, who have dealt with different situations in different ways, and how Krishna also responds to this kind of situation. So there are many examples in our books, in our history, of Vaishnavas who are very poverty-stricken, or Vaishnavas who are very wealthy, or Vaishnavas who are sometimes poverty-stricken, sometimes wealthy, vice versa, many different combinations. So I'll just go through a few different examples. So the first one which springs to mind is Sudama Brahmana, the friend of Lord Krishna, who was a co-student of the Lord in Gurukul. When Krishna went to Sanipani Muni's ashram in Ujjain, Avanti, then he studied for 64 days. And Sudama was one of the students also in the ashram. And there's the famous incident where Sudama and Krishna are stuck in the forest collecting firewood, and there's a torrential storm, and they're stuck there the whole night, and Sanipani Muni rescues them in the morning. So anyway, later on, as is generally the case, the students, Krishna went back to Mathura, Sudama went back to wherever his house was. He entered Grihastha Ashram, and he was living a life of a very renounced Brahmana. In fact, he was so renounced that he was not even eating properly. Brahmana is not supposed to take any employment, so they're supposed to beg for their necessities. But Sudama was very transcendental. He wasn't even doing the minimum amount of begging required to have enough food to survive properly. It became very thin. So his wife was very concerned that, you know, my husband is starving. We have to do something about this. And she knew that Krishna was his great friend, Krishna being Madhava, the husband of the goddess of fortune. So she understood that if he goes to see Krishna, Krishna will surely be reminded of him and adjust his material poverty. So she convinced Sudama. Sudama was hesitant. He didn't want to go to ask Krishna for anything, being a pure devotee of the Lord. But he did like the idea of going to have Krishna's darshan after so many years. So we know the story, how he went to Dwarka with a little bag of very poor quality chipped rice, which his wife baked. And Krishna immediately welcomed him and grabbed the rice and ate it. And ultimately he bestowed upon Sudama great palatial palace, great palatial building and opulence beyond his imagination, even though Sudama had not asked for it. When Krishna met Sudama, he was wondering, how is it that my devotee has become so poor? Have I been neglectful of him? And Krishna was wondering himself. And then in the purport, it's described that there are different kinds of devotees who are two classes of devotees in regards to wealth. There's a class of devotee who are inimical to wealth, and there's a class who are indifferent to wealth. So indifferent means they may have it, they may not have it, they're still equipoised. And inimical means they actually are averse to having wealth. They want to live a very poor, renounced life, and they're more comfortable in that situation. And so Krishna realized that Sudama really didn't need anything. He was quite happy in his poverty-stricken condition. But still, Krishna bestowed upon him amazing opulence. Sudama didn't ask for it even. And when Sudama was going home, he was thinking that Krishna is so merciful. He knew that if I get wealth, even though that was the purpose of my visit, if I got this wealth, then I would be distracted from remembering him, from my Krishna consciousness. So Krishna didn't give me anything. But of course, when he reached home, he was amazed to see his hut, little shanty hut, was gone, and there was this massive palace. And his wife came out. She was so decked out that he couldn't even recognize her at first. She looked just like a goddess of fortune. Probably she was wearing some very, you know, no ornaments, some ripped old clothes previously. So Sudama could not even recognize her at first. If someone comes to Mayapur after 20, 30 years, they'll also have this feeling where you would drive in and there would be just fields. Now, the other day I saw some of the footage of Prabhupada's time. It was playing on the long building Torchlight publishing office. They have a little screen outside. You can see Prabhupada's pastimes. And it looks like, from what I could see, Prabhupada walking in the fields here. From here to Yogapit, there was one tree and nothing else. You know. So if someone comes after 30 years, they'll see, you know, suddenly there are all sorts of, we can't really say palatial buildings, but at least large buildings are there. So Sudama felt like that. But it's described in Bhagavatam that he Although he was worried that he would be distracted in his Krishna consciousness, he continued his practice of devotional service in a very renounced way, even in the midst of so much opulence. So Sudama is an example of a devotee who was very poor. By the mercy of the Lord, he became very opulent. In Lord Chaitanya's Leela, we have Golavesha Sridhar, who I would perhaps, you know, he was not less poverty-stricken than Sudama. Perhaps the difference was he was single, so he didn't have to maintain a wife or a family. Golavesha Sridhar, you know, Lord Chaitanya would joke with him, and everyone would actually joke at him that he's so poor, he doesn't have any proper clothes to wear, he doesn't have any paraphernalia, his house is just one old steel pot which he uses for everything, for bathing, for cooking, for drinking. He has no possessions at all. He just sells some banana leaves, banana flowers, banana fruit, and even whatever income, meager income he gets from that, he offers half of it in service of Ganga Devi. So people used to just make fun of him. And Lord Chaitanya used to also come and harass him and bargain with him and accuse him of trying to cheat, even though Golavesha Sridhar was such a scrupulously honest businessman, if you can even call him a businessman. And during the Mahaprakash Leela, when Lord Chaitanya called for Sridhar, no one even knew who he was, no one even knew his name. And Lord Chaitanya said, "No, the banana seller." And then, "Oh, okay, the banana seller." So then devotees brought him, and Lord Chaitanya was willing to bestow upon him all opulences, just as Krishna did to Sudama. But Golavesha Sridhar didn't have any interest. He remained poor throughout his, as far as I understand, he remained poor. And his material situation did not change, even after the Lord bestowed his mercy, his darshan upon him. So he's an example of a devotee who maintained a life of poverty, of renunciation, all throughout. So then we also have other examples of devotees who were very opulent. In this case, I'm thinking of Pundarik Vidyanidhi. Pundarik Vidyanidhi is the incarnation of Rishabhanu Maharaj. And Lord Chaitanya used to call him, address him as father, Bap. Pundarik Vidyanidhi originally came from the village outside of Chittagong, which is now in Bangladesh. In 2003, I went there with a couple of boys from Gurukul here. And we were there for the annual festival, Pundarik Vidyanidhi's appearance day. So it's a big mela. People come from all over because ISKCON actually has the original property, which was Pundarik Vidyanidhi's house. And there's even a remnant of the pillar, which is from his original house, maybe 600 years ago. So that property actually is it's our temple. It's owned and the deities are there. Pundarik Dham, it's called. So he came from that place to Navadvip. And actually, many great devotees were from Chittagong. Mukunda Datta and Vasudev Datta, I think even the Ghosh brothers, they're all from Chittagong. And there, Mukunda and Vasudev there, Bhajanpatirs, are also just nearby, there are temple there. So they all came, as did many other great devotees from Bangladesh, came to Navadvip to join the Lord's pastimes, Chaitanya Leela. So when Pundarik Vidyanidhi came, no one really knew him because he was from, you know, far away. But Mukunda knew him because he's also from Chittagong. So there's the description of how he told Gadadhar, "I'm going to take you to see a great Vaishnava, come." So they came to visit Pundarik Vidyanidhi. And Pundarik Vidyanidhi was living externally a life of great opulence. And there's a description in the Chaitanya Bhagavat of how he was sitting on a raised, I'm sure it is much bigger than this, asana. It had cushions and the sheets were much whiter than this. They're getting old and gray now. But he had milk-white sheets, and he was being fanned by servants. He had, he was chewing betel nut. His lips were stained red from chewing betel nut, which is another thing which devotees are not supposed to do. And his hair was very long, luxurious, oiled and combed, glossy. And he just, he was dressed very opulently, gold, jewelry, rings, everything, beautiful clothes. And the whole mood was of opulence and enjoyment. So when Mukunda brought Gadadhar, Gadadhar was thinking, "Where has he brought me? He said he's come, he's going to show me a great Vaishnava, but this person looks like a great sense enjoyer." And he didn't say anything, but he had this doubt in his mind. Now, Vaishnava is very subtle. Mukunda could understand his doubt. And he said, oh, Gadadhar is doubtful about the character of Pundarik. So he merely started chanting some shlokas to remind Pundarik of the Lord. And particularly he chanted the verse from third canto, talking about Putana. Oho bakiyam stanakala kutam chikyam sayapayaya dapyasadvi bebe gatim dhatrishitam tatonyam kamva dayalum sharanam vrajema. So the verse is saying, who is more merciful than Krishna, whom I should take shelter of, who gave liberation even to Baki. Baki is the younger brother of Baka, Putana, and Asadvi, the anti-female sadhu. Sadhu and Sadvi is a female sadhu. Asadvi is the anti-sadhu, you can say. The anti-female sadhu. Putana, even though she came with poison to kill Krishna, he accepted her offering and gave her, ultimately gave her the position of his nurse. So who is more merciful than Krishna? So as soon as this verse left Mukunda's mouth, Pundarik Vidyanidhi flew into a frenzy of ecstasy, and he just lost all composure and just started rolling around, flailing his hands and legs, smashing everything. The whole setup was smashed, knocked over, and three or four people were trying to control him, and he was just uncontrollable, frenzy of ecstasy, remembering the Lord's pastimes like this. So immediately when Gadadhar saw this, he understood, oh, I've made an offense to this great personality by doubting him, even mentally doubting him. He considered that an offense. And ultimately he took initiation from Pundarik Vidyanidhi, which of course is very apt, because we know Gadadhar being Radharani and Vrishabhanu had become Pundarik, so it was a very perfect relationship in that way. So this is an example of Pundarik Vidyanidhi, who was a great, great opulent personality. But again, his opulence did not detract or distract him from his Krishna consciousness. So we have Sudama, Sridhar, Pundarik Vidyanidhi. Then we have devotees like the Pandavas, who, there are so many ups and downs in their life, it's hard to really keep track how many times they were opulent, how many times they were destitute. The Pandavas were born when Pandu was living in the forest, so they lived originally a pretty simple life when they were growing up as children. When Pandu passed away, they moved to Hastinapur. They were first time exposed to the life of opulence and royal pleasures. Later on, they were again living in the forest after Duryodhan tried to burn them all in the house of lack at Varanavata. So they were living in hiding for some months in the forest and in small villages and towns. Later on, after they married Draupadi, they came back to Hastinapur. They were given half the kingdom, which they developed by the Lord's mercy to become even more splendid than the heavens. And when Duryodhan came for the Rajasuriya sacrifice, he saw that the Pandavas' opulence exceeded anything imaginable on earth. And again, that sowed, that reignited or gave more fuel to his enviousness of the Pandavas. And then that led to the gambling match where the Pandavas again lost everything. With one stroke, they lost everything. Yudhishthira was the emperor of the world. He had performed the Rajasuriya sacrifice. And after that, you know, few minutes of gambling match, he was destitute once again and nothing. They walked out of Hastinapur with their weapons and their clothes, and that's it. And they had to live like that for so many years in the forest, undergoing so many different hardships. And later on, they had to fight the Battle of Kurukshetra to get back their kingdom. So there's so many reversals in the life of the Pandavas. In fact, there's so many reversals that even Bhishma was astonished that how is it, you know, these Pandavas are such close friends of the Lord. How is it that they're having to suffer like this? It's amazing, incredible. Even to Bhishma, who was a witness to all this and who was himself a great devotee of the Lord. So the Pandavas had to go through so many turbulent times. So how did they handle this? How did they respond to all these reversals? So I think the best way to answer that question is by quoting from Queen Kunti, who was, of course, is the mother of the Pandavas. Mothers always know best. So she gave the summary of how the Pandavas would take these reversals. And in her prayers to Krishna, when Krishna was leaving after the battle, when everything was settled, Krishna was about to go back to Dwarka. So Kunti Devi approached him and offered these wonderful prayers in the 8th chapter of first canto. So Queen Kunti's mood is, and she was witness to all of these atrocities committed on her sons. She was with them for the first time when they were living in the forest between the House of Black and the winning of Draupadi's hand. She was with them the whole time. And the second part, she was not, after the gambling match, she stayed in Hastinapur. She didn't go to the forest with them, but she was with them in spirit and she knew what was going on. So her response was that let these calamities happen again and again and again. Vipada tantu vipada shantu tashashvat tatra tatra jagadguru bhavato darshanam yatsya apunar bhavadarshanam. Let these things happen again and again, because when we're in difficulty, that's the time when you, Krishna, you come to rescue us, and then we get your darshan. Now that everything is settled, we are established, the enemies have been defeated, Yudhishthira is now king, now you're going away. So what is the benefit of that? We'd rather that we have to suffer all these calamities, but then you'll come to rescue us and you'll give us your mercy. So this is Queen Kunti's response to all the atrocities that she and her great devotee sons had to undergo. And moreover, she says that Krishna is the property of the those who are materially exhausted. Tamam akinchana gochara. Janmaishwarya shuddha shribhi edhamana madapuman. People who are maddened by the opulences of high birth, wealth, janma, aishwarya, shruta, great learning, great education, shribhi, great beauty. People who are intoxicated by these things, they naiva hatya vidatum vai tamam akinchana gochara. They do not approach you. They don't approach you. They're too distracted by these great opulences. Whereas people who are materially impoverished, who have nothing, they can very sincerely, very easily cry out to you. So in this way, it seems that high birth, education, beauty, opulence are actually, in one way, disqualifications for approaching the Lord. And Bhagavad Gita also, this is confirmed. Bhogashwarya prasaktanam. Those who are distracted, attached to bhoga and aishwarya, sense gratification, material opulence, they don't have the determination to take shelter of the Lord. So it seems that these qualities are impediments to devotional service. You know, so what does that mean, that devotees should all be poor and ugly and, you know, uneducated and, you know, born in low families? You know, is that what it means? Not necessarily, because it really depends on how one deals with these opulences when they come and how one deals with them when they go. If we see with the Pandavas, their Krishna consciousness, so we see with Sudama, his Krishna consciousness was not affected by his material circumstances. He was always Krishna conscious no matter what his material condition was. Same with the Pandavas. So it really depends if one is distracted by these things. In one sense, it's easier. Prabhupada would also say that, you know, it's very hard to even meet important people, rich people, powerful people. They're not even interested. If you want to get an appointment, you know, you have to see the secretary, you have to wait. They have signs, keep out, beware of dog. You can't easily approach important rich people because they're so proud and they're also so afraid of their of people approaching them to take their money or to, you know, attack them or harass them. Whereas poverty-stricken people, we have a program, they immediately come for prasadam, you know, they don't mind, they'll like to go to holy people, even if it's just for getting so-called blessings. So in one sense, it's much easier for those people to come in contact with devotional service. So if one is distracted by these opulences, then Krishna may take them away. And we see in Srila Prabhupada's life, the other day, Janmashtami Prabhu brought this point up. that Srila Prabhupada was given the instruction by his Guru Maharaj to preach in English. So his idea was that he would, you know, he needs some resources to do that, to print books, to, you know, to do anything. You need some facility. So his idea was, by his business activities, he would, you know, get some capital and he'd be able to establish himself and take up the mission of his spiritual master in that way. But at every juncture, he was being thwarted. He wasn't able to successfully run his business. So many times, so many incidents happened where he lost, had big losses. And that verse that Janmashtami Prabhu quoted, it seems like it was written just for Prabhupada. You know, yasya ham anugrihnami harishyat tat dhanam shanai tatastha tato tyajantyasya svajana dukkha dukkhitam. It really seems to me that it was written just in Prabhupada's case, because a verse is saying that, Krishna is saying, when I'm especially merciful to my devotee, then I take away all his dhana, all his opulence, all his wealth. In that condition, all his relatives reject him. So it's exactly what happened in Prabhupada's life. He was trying to maintain his family. He wanted to have some capital for taking up the printing of, you know, the books in English that his guru had instructed him. But it simply wasn't happening. Although he was trying, sincere motive and the best of his ability, which was considerable, still he wasn't able to be successful in that endeavor. And then his relatives started to, you know, his wife especially, they were not interested. From the beginning, they weren't interested in his spiritual endeavors. And when he wasn't even able to make ends meet properly, they started to lose respect for him. So exactly what this verse describes. And when Prabhupada came across this verse, he realized that, you know, I think this is what's happening to me. And he consulted, I believe, with one of his godbrothers, and they confirmed, yes, this verse is especially applicable to you. The verse after that, which I wasn't aware of till yesterday when I was preparing, says that in such a condition, the afflicted devotee, he takes shelter the afflicted person takes shelter of the devotees. So when his relatives reject him, then he's forced to take shelter of the devotees. And that way his Krishna consciousness is enlivened. So this is exactly what happened to Srila Prabhupada. Now, Srila Prabhupada, after he left his family, he was struggling for many years. He also didn't have any great success when he was trying to establish himself in India. And we know, ultimately, he went to America. How much money did he have?
$40.
$40? $40 rupees. $40 is something. $40 is something. 40 rupees, even, I mean, in the 60s, 40 rupees may be, you know, decent amount of money. But does anyone know what happened to that 40 rupees? What he did with it when he got to New York? Yeah, it wasn't even exchangeable. It wasn't like, you know, you land at JFK airport and you go to the money currency exchange. Here are my 40 rupees, you know, now you get like 80 cents for it. Maybe he would get $50 in those days, I don't know. But he couldn't even exchange it. 40 rupees had only the value of paper. So he, actually ultimately what Prabhupada did with that 40 rupees, when he came back to India, maybe 67, after he had that health crisis, he came back with Kirtanananda. And they landed in Delhi, and he took a taxi from the airport to his Chippiwada temple where he had the room. And he paid the 40 rupees to the taxi driver. That's what, you know, that's how much use the 40 rupees was for him in America. And not just that, but the whole first year, if you read Prabhupada's, what's it called? The beginning, the book that is the BBT produced about Prabhupada's diary was discovered that he kept for that first year, both on the Jaladuta and when he reached New York, when he went to Butler, when he was staying with Dr. Mishra in New York, before he established ISKCON, basically, up to those very early days. You can read, you know, he keeps track of his expenses, 30 cents for bus fare. I sold one set of Bhagavatam for $7, whatever it was. Very interesting. You can see how Prabhupada was really struggling financially in those early days. And he even went back to the Jaladuta office to check, you know, when is the next boat back? Maybe I just, you know, I just have to pack up. I can't do this. It's not working. So Prabhupada was tested very severely in those early days, without any facility, without any help. And of course we know how things started progressing. And you know, ultimately Prabhupada, later on he would boast, when he came back to India, he would boast that to his Indian, you know, people who come to see him, that every day we're spending so many lakhs of rupees, and our Los Angeles temple has so much facility, we have so many cars, and the neighbors are envious. You know, how are these sadhus, they got so much money, they have so many buildings, but they won't join us, of course. You know, Prabhupada would comment, and he would show off to his Indian you know, friends, and not even followers, just guests who would come to see him, associates, that see how much opulence we have now. But it's not that Prabhupada changed. It's not that when he got, you know, a big house in LA, or when he got a nice temple in Calcutta, or a nice lotus building here, that he became some kind of sense enjoyer and started demanding things and enjoying that opulence. Just like Sudama, when he had nothing, he was Krishna conscious, lived simply. Prabhupada also, he had nothing, and he lived very simply, even when he had so much facility. Everything was for the service of the Lord. And Prabhupada didn't accept any extra opulence for himself. This is a perfect way, perfect example, how to use all facility in the service of the Lord. And final example of perhaps the even more graphic than the Pandavas, someone who had even more opulence than the Pandavas and who lost everything in a moment, is Bali Maharaj. And Bali Maharaj, he took over the entire universe, not just the planet, not just the kingdom. The entire universe was under his control. Now, he was running everything. The demigods were in hiding. He was, you know, just unrivaled power, you know, like Hiranyakashipu, unrivaled. And just from the three steps of land that he gave to Lord Vamana, in a few moments he was stripped of everything he had, stripped of his respect, stripped of his honor. He was tied up by the ropes of Varuna. Garuda tied him up, imprisoned, you know, captured him. And even the demons were angry with him. They wanted to attack Lord Vamana. And he said, don't do that. So he was just left with nothing. And he couldn't even fulfill his promise. The third step of land, which he promised to Lord Vamana, by cheating, apparent cheating, the Lord took away everything in two steps. And he said, where's my third step? You can't give it? Okay, I arrest you. You know, if you make a promise, you don't fulfill your contract, then you're liable for punishment. So Bali Maharaj was tied up, and, you know, and in such a situation, in one moment, he lost every single, everything stripped from him. And he was feeling ashamed on top of that, that I can't fulfill my word, I can't give the third step. Now, even though his own guru had told him, don't do it, you don't need to do it, this is a trick, you don't have to go through with this. And he was even trying to give some shastric backup. You know, you didn't say Om before you made this promise. And this is Lord Vishnu, he's coming to steal everything. In an emergency situation, you don't have to fulfill your word. He's cheating you, so you don't have to stoop to his level. You have to maintain yourself, you can't lose everything. Of course, Shukracharya was not giving him very good advice. He was concerned about his own situation, from being guru of the king of the universe to being, you know, to being a nobody. Shukracharya had his own motive. So Bali Maharaj rejected even his spiritual master's advice and surrendered everything to the Lord. He said, it doesn't matter who he is, even if he's the Lord, even if he's come to cheat me, I have to fulfill my word. I gave it to a Brahmana, apparent Brahmana. So in that condition, Bali Maharaj, he's the example of Atma Nivedana, one who surrenders everything to the Lord. And the Lord was actually very pleased with Bali Maharaj's surrender. And he bestowed upon him, it's not that he just took away everything and left him with nothing and kicked him out, but he was very pleased with Bali Maharaj's surrender, his mood especially. And he bestowed upon him the, what is it, Sutala planet, which is considered even more opulent than Indra's planet. And not only that, he even became his guard. The Lord became his guard. And he always stands at the gate of Bali Maharaj's palace. My notes flew away, so I'm not sure what's next. So, when Bali Maharaj was tied up by Lord Vamana, then the Lord uttered one shloka, which for me was like a very nice conclusion of this topic. This is from the 8th canto. Manastambha nimittanam janmadinam samantata Sarvashreya Pratipanam Hantamohyana Namat Para. 8.22.27. Although aristocratic birth and other such opulences are impediments to advancement in devotional service, because they are sources of false prestige and pride, these opulences never disturb a pure devotee or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So if one is a pure devotee, then he won't be disturbed by these opulences. Same ones, Janmaishwarya Shruta Shribi, the Lord is himself saying, I don't disturb a devotee of the Lord, a pure devotee of the Lord. So that begs the question, do they disturb practicing devotees of the Lord or neophyte devotees of the Lord? So it's another interesting topic which we can touch on. And I'm reminded of the incident in Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's time when he told Srila Prabhupada that when we were just preaching simply with a few brahmacharis, everything was very peaceful. But now we have this big marble temple, Bagh Bazar Gauriya Math, and devotees are squabbling who's going to get which room, who's going to get which facility. And I really don't like this mood among the devotees. They're supposed to be renounced. They were renounced. But now we have all this facility and they're starting to fight among each other, even in my presence. Better we should rip up the marble from the temple, sell the marble, and get money to print books. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was himself feeling that with the advent of opulence and facility, the mood of the devotees, the renunciation, cooperation, these things were going down. And he personally told this to Prabhupada. So this is a kind of stark warning. These devotees in those times, I would assume they're much more, at least their background is much better than ours, and their association with Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, personal training by him, much greater association they had, opportunities at least, much more advanced than us, I would expect. But in that situation, coming from a simple background, coming into opulence, they were getting distracted and bewildered. So this is another warning for us in modern day ISKCON. If we, by our post or our position in management we may get from facility, how we respond to that, how we use those resources is very important. How we should just use it in Krishna service, not consider that anything is mine, that I deserve this facility, I deserve a fancy phone with the bills paid. We have to be very, maintain the spirit of renunciation, which our predecessors have shown us. Otherwise, the verse says, they never disturb a pure devotee of the Supreme Lord. Now, if one considers that he's worthy of this respect, worthy of these facilities, and starts to become proud, then we've seen time and again in our society, such devotees start to shake, they have problems, their material desires return, and ultimately they have a lot of trouble in the execution of their devotional service. So this is a reminder for all of us, please keep in mind, if we get any facility, everything ultimately is coming from Krishna. We may feel, oh, this came from my family, this came from some other situation, but ultimately everything is coming from the Lord to be used in His service only. And then, no matter how much opulence we have, beauty, knowledge, high birth, these things will not be distractions in our devotional service, but they could rather be embellishments. So, I think we should end here. Unless anyone has anything to add or anything to query, comments or questions. Hare Krishna. Can I come up?
Hare Krishna. I understood that when Prabhupada arrived by taxi, that it was Brahmananda who was with him. Is that right? Or?
No, I think it was the first time Kirtananda came with him.
Anyway, he knew that Prabhupada had some money, and he didn't have any money at all. And he was waiting, for Prabhupada to pay the taxi driver. And Prabhupada held on to the money for some time. And then Prabhupada looked at him and said, "That's the 40 rupees. That's the 40 rupees." And the 40 rupees actually was worth about $10. But he got some money by selling Bhagavatams on the boat.
Yeah.
Another question is, didn't Bali Maharaj, didn't he say that the third step should go on his head?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he offered his head as the third step. Thank you. Okay, thank you all very much. Grantra Srimad Bhagavatam Ki, Shri Prabhupada Ki, Om Brahmanandi.